This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
It's Wednesday, March the 27th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. It is 3 days now since Simon Harris was confirmed without a contest as the new leader of Fine Gael. Harris is scheduled to be elected Taoiseach when the Dáil returns on Tuesday, April the 9th. And there has been no shortage of commentary in the pages of the Irish Times and elsewhere about the meaning of all these events of the last week since Leo Varadkar announced that he was stepping down. And in recent days, that focus has tended to be on Harris himself. What sort of a politician is he? What can we learn from his record? And what sort of a Taoiseach is he going to be? I'm joined today in studio by political correspondent Jennifer Bray and on the line by columnist Fintan O'Toole. Hello to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Jen, I'll go to you first. Any kind of updates on the shape of the future cabinet? There's ongoing gossip about ministerial reshuffles. Anything new?
I think at the moment Simon Harris is kind of sitting down with his team and trying to figure out how extreme should I go? Should I be, you know, I think the Indo we're calling this morning, does he go hatchet Harris or does he go hesitant Harris? And I think that's a really good way of describing it because they're the options open to him. He could make extensive changes in cabinet. The danger with doing that, of course, is that there's a wider stability in the coalition to be mindful of. And if you make major drastic changes to personalities across the board, it completely upsets that. However, if Fine Gael are looking towards an election, which they are, he is going to have to argue that as Taoiseach and as leader of Fine Gael, he has brought about a new, revitalised, renewed party that is somehow different. And I think if he is really going to do that, he has to present a team with new faces. So the speculation that I've heard at the moment, there's a lot of speculation that Helen McEntee will be moved out of justice. That will be a big move for him to make. She's obviously viewed as being, you know, one of his biggest rivals, effectively, and was viewed as a leadership contender, although she obviously ruled herself out and said it wasn't for her, but maybe another day. There's a vacancy created by him leaving higher education. Who does he put there? There's a lot of talk about maybe somebody like Peter Burke moving up to the ranks, Martin Hayden, and maybe Jennifer Carroll McNeill. So there's a lot of moving parts there. It's up to him to decide whether he clears the decks. One thing that I did think was interesting was that he had put it out through his team that he wanted people who effectively can guarantee that they're going to run again in the next election. He didn't want ministers who were just cruising to the next election and then leaving.
And then Simon Coveney and Pascal Donoghue came out like a shot, both of them, and said they were running again.
Coveney was really interesting because in the last couple of weeks particularly, everybody who I've spoken to in government, everybody bar nobody, expected him to step down. And at the weekend, when Harris made his speech, which I'm sure you'll get into, Simon Coveney turned up like as if he had just been plugged in for the first time in years. And he kind of had this extraordinary energy. And I just wondered, did he get that from having a fire lit underneath him?
So yeah, there's nothing like the prospect of being sacked to, you know, give you a jolt, is there?
I mean, yeah, like if you told me I'd be sacked tomorrow unless I come on this podcast, you'd be damn sure I'd be here talking all kinds of stuff. But yeah, so I think that strengthens Simon Coveney's chances of remaining in cabinet and Pascal Donoghue as well. So it actually makes it harder for Simon Harris to sweep the decks if his team around him are saying, oh no, I'm definitely staying. So
yeah,
he has a big choice now.
And you add to that, you know, there's a lot of talk that Heather Humphreys had a chat with him in advance of coming out to support him. And so her position, I think we could take it, is pretty secure. The idea of getting rid of Pascal Donoghue is complicated further by the fact it would disrupt the kind of financial core of this government and also his presidency of the Eurogroup. So you're not, because Fine Gael only have, five ministers, there's not that much to play with, really.
No, obviously, Josephine Madigan, there's a place to be filled there. Mm. You know, we had her statement last Friday. There isn't, unless he decides to do something daring, basically, is what I'm saying, and to sack some well-known faces.
One thinks of that yes minister line when he says, very brave, Prime Minister, very brave.
Yes, exactly. And actually, I think the Heather Humphreys thing is so interesting because she has down through the years got a lot of flack, I think, from people who said she's not a tenable leadership candidate, you know, she's not the real deal or whatever. She doesn't have what it takes. Whereas she, you know, she detected exactly what way the wind was blowing and she did consider it on the Wednesday night, but she did talk to her family, and I do know that. But then on Thursday morning, very early, we could all see which way the cookie was crumbling. And she had a meeting with Harris before 10 a.m., and said, I will support you. And I, you know, I think the plan was that she would be the first minister. In the end, it was actually Helen McEntee, who's the first cabinet minister, to give Harris her support. And there was a deal done. That's what I'm told. And she would be the deputy leader and she would retain her position in cabinet. She has a couple of things she wants to bring through, like auto enrolment, pensions and all that kind of stuff. So that's my expectation. She remains and is the deputy leader. And she is, as described to me, a darling of the Fine Gael grassroots. So it makes sense from that perspective too to put her in that role.
Right, Fintan, can I ask you, I want to talk to you in a moment about your very interesting column about Simon Harris yesterday, but just all this kind of rumour and speculation and stuff, does it amount to very much?
I would say from the point of view of the general public, it probably amounts to pretty damn all, you know, because, I mean, if you stand back from this and you just think about it, leave aside all the issues of ideology or direction of government, I mean, what is it you're trying to do if you're a political party and you have public attention on you? You're trying to create a story. You're trying to create a drama. You're this is a new era for Fine Gael. We have a new leader. Why? And if you just look at it from that point of view, I mean, this was as bad as the last episode of Game of Thrones or something. You know, it's everybody's expecting some kind of drama, and it's all wrapped up, with indecent haste.
Would they have been better off having a contest?
Much better off. You know, I mean, if you just think about it from the point of view of the public, who probably don't tune in to the fine details of politics on a day-to-day level, you have a moment of great drama, you know, a young Taoiseach stepping down, you know, and it coming out of the blue. I mean, it's a great way to get the public's attention. But what do you do with that attention? You know, you short-circuit it completely. You know, there's been no debate. There's been no discussion. There's been no real explanation as to why Simon Harris. I mean, why is he the best person? What does he really stand for? What does Fine Gael stand for? I mean, the party should have had at least a week or more, maybe 2 weeks of public drama, in which, you know, the ordinary citizen would be tuned in to what this party was about and what it's supposed to stand for and what its promises of the future are. So it seemed to me to be completely botched, you know, I still don't understand why senior figures like Pascal Donoghue just ran scared or disappeared from this whole narrative, you know. So it's like we had a kind of drama starting. We had the first act, and then, you know, at the beginning of the second act, somebody just comes out on stage and says, actually, it's all over and it's Simon. You know, that's it.
Well, part of it, Jen, was because of the ruthless efficiency of the Harris operation on Thursday, wasn't it? If that had been not quite as efficient, do you think that a Pascal Donoghue or a Heather Humphreys might have acted differently?
I think 65% of it was ruthless efficiency, and I think the rest of it was either organic or opportunistic. Because, like, you have to view what happened last week in the context of what's been happening behind the scenes in Fine Gael for the last 10 years, but especially the last 5 years. And Simon Harris kind of, now, I say two-faced, I don't mean it in the nasty kind of way, like we all have many faces. But Simon Harris does...
That's quite...
diplomatic. We all have many faces. But Simon Harris has this kind of public sort of live, laugh, love online persona where he never says anything controversial. He has his Instagram videos and you know, there's a whole world of stuff you could get into there in terms of the conversation. But there's another side to him. He didn't get to be Taoiseach designate and leader of Fine Gael simply by chance. He has been cunning. He has been a political strategist down through the years. One of the things that he has been really good at behind the scenes is taking the temperature or taking, basically being a sounding board and figuring out what's going on with the party. Like, if there's a controversy, how serious is this for the minister? If it was around Helen McEntee and judges, for example, he would be kind of figuring out in the party when is the time to pounce effectively. And I thought if there was ever a time that he was going to, if there was going to, let's say, be a heave, it would have been around the time of the Leo Varadkar leaking the GP contract controversy. And he decided not to. But I think what's been going on is he has been slowly accumulating the support of his colleagues while also maybe behind the scenes kind of laying doubts about his colleagues, perhaps, or saying, you know, is this person in trouble or is that person in trouble? And I think he's been strategic like that, but he's always managed to avoid bringing that out into the public realm.
There was a little spat about him being the alleged leaker of something come out of cabinet a while ago. Does he have, let me phrase it this way, does he have an amiable relationship with the press?
I think he had a much more amiable relationship with the press a couple of years ago. I think when the controversy erupted around the National Children's Hospital and the cost of it and what he knew about that, I think that soured a little bit, because I remember one of my first days when I went down to the Dáil, it was either 2014, 2015, he had just recently been appointed as the junior minister for finance. And when you started in the Dáil, nobody knows you and nobody wants to talk to you. Basically, you're just nobody. But he made a beeline for me, and he, you know, we have to meet up and we have to get coffee. And I think that was really reflective of the, not only his general personality, like he is quite genuine in some ways. All politicians have a side of them that's quite cunning, right? So I remember thinking, wow, he's really on it, you know. And all throughout the following years, my experience of him and watching him with other journalists was that he had a very easy relationship. And when he became the Minister for Health, I think that changed, because it's a very tricky portfolio. And I remember around the time of the National Children's Hospital stuff, like I was working on that story. We were breaking a lot of stuff in the Irish Times around it. And certainly I found that my relationship with him wasn't quite the same, because obviously I was writing stuff that was deeply, deeply unpleasant for him. And yet afterwards, he seemed to kind of just bounce back after he moved into the COVID role. That's the sign of a politician who... It's always the politicians in my world who are the most sensitive and who decide, I'm never talking to you again because you wrote that horrible thing about me, who tend to not really do well. I think that he knows the power of the media, and he knows that if he plays ball, I think it's better for him.
So let's talk a little bit, Fintan, about his time in health, because it is by far really the most significant part of his career as a senior politician. The position he's occupied for the last few years is probably the most junior one at the cabinet table, and certainly not as onerous and as difficult as health. Your column is really interesting because it points to two facts which seem to be very contradictory or paradoxical. One is that health is viewed as the minefield, the Angola, the potential graveyard of political ambitions. And the other is that most of the Taoiseach that we've had this century have passed through its doors at one point or another. And you look to reconcile those two facts.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about our Taoiseach as former ministers for health, I think is a good prism through which we can question the basic idea, right, which is that people who have great achievements in politics are the ones who become Taoiseach, you know. So we have, as you say, we've had, Simon Harris becomes Taoiseach, we will have had five new Taoiseach this century, and four of them will have been Minister for Health. That's Brian Cowan, Micheál Martin, Leo Varadkar, and now presumably Simon Harris. The only one who wasn't was Enda Kenny. And you would therefore think, right, so they have accumulated between them nearly a dozen years in the Department of Health. So you'd say, well, if you were looking at this, you know, ask the computer to come out with some kind of prediction, they would say, this is the best run department, you know, in this country. It's had the brightest and the best, the stellar political talents have all had their hands on the Department of Health. And my God, just look at the state of it, you know. So not one of them has really tackled the fundamental problems that bedevil the health service. You know, the health service is fundamentally as dysfunctional as it was when Cowan got his hands on it, and Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar and Simon Harris, you know. So there is really no evidence to suggest that in this very difficult department that it's people who prove themselves there as being really capable of tackling fundamental questions who are going to emerge as our best politicians. And this is as true of Simon Harris as it is for any of the others. He really does not have a record as Minister for Health. I mean, he was 4 years in the department. A significant part of that was COVID. But in terms of dealing with big issues, the two people that he appointed, who were very, very talented people, there was Laura McGahey and there was Professor Tom Keane, whom people might remember was the one who did one of the biggest things that the health service has done, which is to reconfigure cancer services. So these are two very talented, serious people. They both resigned in frustration shortly after Simon Harris left the Department of Health, saying there's no will really to implement Sláintecare, which is supposed to be the big medium and long term plan for changing the way the health service works. So he's good at the PR of it. He was good at sort of, obviously if you've got 20 odd billion to spend, you're going to do a few decent things. Did he make any impact? I would say no. I mean, even things, I mean, Jen mentioned the Children's Hospital, for example, there's no evidence that he got control of that at all. You think about one of the big promises being made was to introduce free GP care for the under eights. That didn't happen during his term of office. Very, very slow. And never mind, it's supposed to be rolled out down to the under 10s and the under 12s, which still hasn't happened. So whether you take sort of specific policies, there's no great impact there. But more importantly, I think you take the fact that everybody who's ever looked at the health service understands that it can't work. It's completely inefficient because of its hybrid public-private nature. And it's also completely inequitable. We have a two-tier system. Those two facts remain unaltered for Simon Harris's term in health.
I'll come back to what it means for Simon Harris in a moment, but just to dig into that a little bit more, maybe, Jen, you come on this. I mean, Fintan's referring there to the fact that Sláintecare, which is a plan for the complete redesign, I suppose, of our health service to bring in a, universal health care for all, if free at the point of entry, as I understand it, like the NHS, but better, I think, would be the idea, that was proposed by members of the Oireachtas who weren't in government, Roisin Shortall first among them. And it was signed up to, this is the bit I don't understand, it was signed up to by all the other parties, but I've always had the sense that they may have signed up to it, but they don't necessarily believe in it.
Yeah, it's almost like because they didn't devise it themselves, they don't feel that sense of ownership and aren't as invested in it. And Fintan mentioned those two resignations, which were very telling, because they would have been two very high-profile appointments in relation to delivering this Sláintecare plan. Even if you look at what Sinn Féin are promising in the next election, should they be in government, they're promising effectively, like you said, an Irish NHS. The problem is so gigantic that I think no health minister has ever managed to even get their teeth into it. The health system is so far gone that all any health minister that I've seen or witnessed has managed to do is maybe to chip away at it. Like, if you look at what Stephen Donnelly has done over the last year, it's probably an unpopular thing to say because the popular thing nowadays is just bash politicians all the time. But he actually has made some progress. But the progress is off such a high mountain that it's almost indiscernible.
And that's Are we talking about structural progress here? Waiting list. So we're talking about actual progress on the service provided to the people.
Yeah. And I think that the Sláintecare thing is, and the real question is, and it's one that no health minister has managed to properly bring to the fore, is are we ready as a public, as a country, to invest or to create a health system that is not two-tier when you have so many people with private health insurance who are more than happy maybe to pay, or maybe they can pay and are happy to get quicker access to scans, services or whatever.
Or at the very least might be fearful of whether they'll get the same quality of service that they would currently in a new amalgamated system.
Which is understandable. People want to have ready access to scans. If you've got something wrong or you're concerned about something, of course you want to be able to get a scan as soon as possible, whatever it may be, or a test. And I think that's the issue there. And as long as there is no minister or government willing to grasp the fundamental concept of Sláintecare and abolishing this two-tier system, I don't think we'll ever have a health minister who will actually make tangible progress, because in my view, otherwise you're only chipping away at the outside parts. You're throwing a bit of money at the National Treatment Purchase Fund. You're bringing in private hospitals to take over some of the appointments. Although I will give credit again to Stephen Donnelly for the consultants only contract, which we see more and more consultants signing up to, which is a good thing, I think. But it's a mountain, and it's a mountain that nobody has ever climbed. And it's so interesting that Fintan pointed out that all of these men who are Taoiseach have previously been ministers for health, and they have survived health. They haven't conquered it. They've just survived
Emerged unscathed, I think, is the... I may have even used it myself, you know, at one point or another. Fintan, you are our country's leading expert on how Irish people say one thing and mean another. So this seems particularly applicable in this case, maybe not just for the political establishment, but maybe for the people who vote in the politicians as well.
Yeah, I mean, when was the last time a major political party proposed a radical change in the way the health service worked? And actually, it was Fine Gael, you know. James O'Reilly, who you know might be a controversial figure, but he was steeped in the health service. And the Irish Times carried an interview last week, for example, with John Crown, the breast cancer consultant, you know, whom people would know. He's kind of semi-retired now, and a kind of an anguished interview with him talking about how the system doesn't work. And he's been a passionate advocate for an insurance-based system, right? And James O'Reilly took that up. O'Reilly was Minister for Health. And you can disagree with this, right? You can say there's a better way of funding or whatever, but at least he had a coherent plan. And the coherent plan was that, as Jen was saying, the problem is, right, how do you start from the fact that over 40% of people have private health insurance in a system whereby they're supposed to be entitled to free public care? And the answer to that, and it is at least a coherent answer, is, right, you have basically insurance for everybody, right? So you have an insurance-based system. State will provide insurance for those who can't afford it themselves. People will pay it who can afford it. And that way you have an equitable system, and that way the money follows the patient, right? So you have a system whereby you don't get paid as a hospital or as a doctor unless you're treating people. Mm. What we've got at the moment are these perverse incentives, right? Because you've got this mix of private and public, whereby the incentive is often for the public system, the people who work, or the people at the top of the public system, not to treat too many people, because then those people won't go and seek private care. So, okay, there was a coherent plan, right? You could criticize it at all sorts of ways, but it's the kind of plan that works in a lot of European countries. The German system, for example, would be exactly like that, right? And it's better than ours, right? It may not be perfect, but it's a hell of a lot better than ours is. It's more equitable and it's more efficient, right? What happened to that? You know, was just, they just gave up. You know, it's just like Riley was removed, Leo Varadkar replaced him, and this is interesting. Another kind of, you know, rising star comes in. What was the first thing Leo Varadkar came in and said? No, we're not doing that. You know, no real explanation and nothing put in its place. You know, and then the Sláinte Care thing is fascinating, right? Because the Oireachtas is never allowed to do anything in our system, right? It's a rubber stamp. What did they do? They handed up. They hand the future of the healthcare service over to an Oireachtas, special Oireachtas committee. Why? Because the ministers don't want it. You know, I mean, Jen was saying they don't take ownership of it, but that's because they didn't want to take ownership of it. You know, and they hand it over to. I mean, this is extraordinary. A TD from a minor opposition party, the Social Democrats, is the one who's in charge of drafting the medium and long term strategy for the entire healthcare service, you know, and that's the plan, that's the map. I mean, this is an extraordinary just abandonment of political responsibility, you know, and it's saying it's too difficult, there's too many problems, and I think one of the things is nobody wants to be in the Department of Health long term, right? So, I mean, to be fair to Stephen Donnelly, and you know, as Jen was saying, he you know maybe sometimes rightly gets a lot of stick, but he's interested in trying to do things which might have some sort of long-term impact, right? And, you know, isn't just stuff that's good for his profile, you know, like the public-only hospital consultant contracts. That's really, really important in terms of changing the system. But you know, there's a sense that he won't get any thanks for that, that his political career is not going to thrive on the basis of those longer-term things. You know, so there's a whole set of problems here around how we cover politics, about how, you know, how we criticize people, but primarily about the lack of kind of long-term thinking. But I think it does come back to this question, you know, since we're talking about Simon Harris and the elevation of a Taoiseach, you know, is there's clearly no penalty in terms of your political career for getting out of health alive, you know, as I'm saying that column, and you know, it's about survival, right? So, you know, if you manage to get through the minefield and you're still intact, that's the aim. The aim isn't to have fundamentally changed things for the better. You know, people are talking about the National Health Service in Britain and all that, and the way it's collapsing, and there's a big play on in London at the moment about Nye Bevan, who created it. I mean, they created a National Health Service in what, 3 or 4 years, because they really wanted to. And you had leadership, you had visionary leadership, you know. And what we don't have in Ireland is visionary leadership. And whatever Simon Harris's many good qualities, I'm sure, but, you know, visionary leadership certainly isn't going to be one of them.
I suppose, and we don't want to make this completely about Sláinte Kéire and the health system, 1945 to 1949 in the United Kingdom was a very different political moment than the last 20 years in Irish politics. And, you know, the introduction of those social democratic measures in the UK and lots of other European countries as well around the same time was stymied in Ireland because of the control of the medical system by conservative medical establishment and the Catholic hierarchy, wasn't it? You know, it goes all the way back to that ultimately.
It does. No, you're absolutely right. And this is why we've ended up with this system, which is a kind of, you know, it's like one of these medieval drawings of a mythical beast, you know, that has, it's part socialist, you know. So we have at the core of this, supposedly, right, a free hospital system. I mean, everybody in Ireland is entitled to free hospital care. But of course, then that's not made effective because you also have tied onto that, you have a business model, right, which is effectively, it's, you know, the health service exists to make money for a lot of people. And then you have a charitable model, which is the church one, you know, which is still there. We still have so-called voluntary hospitals. Simon Harris, by the way, was someone who saw no problem at all in handing over the new maternity hospital to nuns. You know, it didn't occur to him that there was a problem about that. You know, you think about what planet has he grown up on? You know, anyway, that's a whole other question. But we have that model. And then, of course, we have very, very powerful professional interests, you know, so the consultants being the most obvious ones, but there's lots of other ones as well there, you know. So you have this kind of hybrid system in which you cannot manage it because you can't really see exactly where the money is going. So more and more money goes into it. We now, I mean, it used to be the case we could say, well, actually, if we just put more money into the system, it'd be better. But, you know, actually, there is an awful lot of money going into the system between the, if you put the private and the public together, we put in absolutely enough money to have a decent healthcare system.
We put in far more per capita than many other countries, which have a less, I suppose, positive demographic profile than us, have more old people to take care of. Yeah,
absolutely. And so it doesn't work because you can't really see exactly what's happening to the money. You know, where does the money follow the patient? I mean, you know, this is the key question. And in large parts of the system, it clearly doesn't. There are disincentives, right? So, where should we be putting money? We should be putting money into communities. You know, everybody knows this. Like, this is not even controversial, right? So the most obvious thing is you put most money into the cheapest, most efficient parts of the system, which are the medical services in your village, in your town, you know, in your community. 90% of stuff can be dealt with at that level. A huge amount of it can be dealt with at if you have kind of proper regional hospitals which deal with, you know, with relatively minor things. What we do is we push everything into the most expensive part of the system. You know, we push it all into very, very expensive hospital care, which is often not what people even want. You know, I mean, of course, there are circumstances in which you absolutely need to be in a high-tech hospital, but most stuff does not require that, or certainly does not require it for a long period. You know, you might be in there for 3 or 4 days, but then you would want to have step-down facilities, all of those kinds of things. Why have we never managed to put enough money into the cheaper parts of the system, which are very efficient? I mean, the heroes of our healthcare system, you know, are the GPs. You know, I mean, they actually do provide, you know, again, we can criticize the individual GPs or the whole system and everything, but, you know, they're the ones who are on the ground providing these services. And, you know, I'm in the north side of Dublin, it's impossible to get an appointment with the GP now, or to sign up with a GP, you know, for younger people, because there's just not enough GPs. You know, I mean, you know, so you can, everybody knows exactly what these problems are. But there has never really been political will to, as it were, start from scratch and say, actually, we're going to change the way this thing works. I said the last plan to do that was James Riley's one, which was a Fine Gael plan. It was their big flagship thing. You know, when they got re-elected in 2011, this was to be the good news. So it was all bad news. It was all austerity. It was all, you know, the banking crisis and all that stuff. But the one big thing they were going to do was this, and they didn't do it.
We'll take a quick break. We'll be back after this.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
So, Jen, Fintan laid out the pretty bleak reality. I think most people would accept that it's reality, what he describes. There have been some incremental improvements, as you mentioned earlier on, under Stephen Donnelly, who it strikes me is, you know, the first health minister in a while who did possibly actually want the job at the time of the formation of this government. There is a thing which you notice with Simon Harris, which is he's a very different person from Leo Varadkar, but his career arc is not entirely dissimilar. And one of the things that the health portfolio has been used for by previous Taoiseach has been to put manners on young upstarts who might in future be a threat to their leadership. But is that not one of the reasons why Leo Varadkar got the job, you know, in the first coalition government 10 years or so ago? And certainly I got the impression of that with Simon Harris getting the job. So the political test, completely apart from the really serious issues which Fintan just laid out there, is, okay, go on. Let's see you get out of that. And it's a natural political reaction from somebody put in that position to just cover their back and, you know, count down the clock until they escape.
And that is exactly what happened because, you know, at the time when Harris was put into or appointed as Minister for Health, he was already being viewed very much as future contender, even at that stage, 2016. And there is, and like you said, the same with Leo Varadkar, there's this feeling that we'll put you in there and let's see if you sink or swim. And I think it's really interesting, having listened to everything that Fintan said about James Riley's, you know, the plan that he tried to put forward, the things that different health ministers have done, particularly Fine Gael down through the years, as long as the Department of Health is at the whims of passing politicians and their different personalities, it's really hard to see any proper change ever happening because look at what Fintan said about Leo Varadkar coming in. He just ditched it and didn't give an explanation. And I think it's really extraordinary, actually, if you look at it through that prism, it's actually a little bit depressing. And one of the reasons why I think Stephen Donnelly went in and seems to have had a real desire to get his teeth into things behind the scenes that don't particularly make for shiny graphics or, you know, easy sound bites on Morning Ireland or whatever, I actually know he could listen to this and completely disagree. I think he has never expected to get re-elected in the next election. And I think he decided, okay, fuck it, basically. I'm going to...
So that's a very different approach.
I think
a very
yeah.
different approach to the job.
Yeah, it's almost, in some ways, depoliticising, isn't it, health, which has been heavily politicised, like you said. And even if you look at when Simon Harris was a Minister for Health, in some ways I can understand how it comes to be like that. So throughout those couple of years, massive controversies did erupt. Cervical check, children's hospital. And it's like, you know, Hydra, you cut off the head of one controversy and another one springs forth. And if so much of your job is putting out fires, it does beg the question, how much time is actually left to get stuck into the real structural problems when you are dealing with keeping your own career afloat and also people's lives.
It's the old cliche is the urgent becomes the enemy of the important, you know, so it all becomes about firefighting. Fintan, I had an interesting email from a listener over the course of the weekend who was giving out about the podcast. It rarely happens, but it did happen in this instance, and was complaining that, and I quote here actually, contributors are imitating the main government parties by not focusing enough on the issues on the ground, but rather on talking about ideology. This was in relation to what we were talking about, the conniptions in Fine Gael last week. And I take that on board to one point, but I think we have been talking about a specific issue here and the one that Simon Harris has been most associated with. But you can't quite leave ideology out of it, can you? And a lot of the discussion over the last week or so, for good or ill, has been about where Fine Gael is positioned. And ideology, in theory at least, should drive policy and should drive outcomes. Would we be better off with a Fine Gael which was avowedly and clearly centre-right on all of these issues, but take the one that we're talking about now, health, rather than this just, you know, fuzziness?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. And actually, the listener raised very pertinent things, you know, which is, what do we mean by ideology in the context of contemporary Irish politics, right? So what we've got is, and I think this is the underlying problem, right, which is that... The this is not on my part an ideological statement. I am very ideological, right? And I am a social democrat. But objectively speaking, Ireland is a social democratic country. Why? Partly because of the way the population has changed, partly because of the different levels of social transformation which we've had, but primarily simply because it is an underdeveloped society with a rapidly growing population, right? That's why it's social democratic, folks. It's not really to do with the fact that people have, had a Pauline conversion to left of center ideas. The state has to grow, right? This is not me saying this, from the left. I mean, read what Ibeck talks about, for example. If you had business leaders on here, they'd be talking about how they want more state investment. We need more education. We need more healthcare. We need more housing. We need more infrastructure, so it is not really controversial that we need a bigger state, but we have in Fine Gael, the party which has been in office since 2011, a centre-right party which does not want to articulate itself as a social democratic party, right? So, this is the sort of weird thing. It had a kind of a social democratic background. It sort of ditched that. The Leo Varadkar, his instincts were essentially neoliberal. I mean, there's no question about Leo Varadkar, if he were in Britain, would have been in the Conservative Party, would have been his natural home. I think the same is true of Simon Harris, right? So we have this kind of weird situation where we have essentially a sort of left of center-ish government being run by people who don't really believe in it. And this is where ideology is important, right? Which is, you have to have some kind of medium and long-term commitment to a certain vision, right? To certain values, to certain ways in which you want the society to go, in order to have a coherent approach to everyday problems, right? So ideology is not something that's kind of floating up there abstract, from housing and healthcare and all these. When you talk about any one of these issues, there are different approaches, So if you believe that the market is ultimately going to solve the housing problem, which is what Fine Gael believes, you end up with what we've got, right? Which is a failure of state provision. With huge consequences for the whole society. And in fact, and this is the great irony of all of this, right, is that one of the things right-of-centre politics has been doing in Ireland is cutting the ground from under right-of-centre politics. What do I mean by that? I mean that what's the great mechanism for taking people and integrating them into a capitalist liberal democracy is home ownership, right? That's, it's not a secret, right? How do you...
That was Margaret Thatcher's magic weapon, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, precisely. Mm. I mean, how do you solidify a small C conservative society, right? You say our fundamental mechanism, we might be doing lots of different things, but the fundamental mechanism is that you if you get an education, you get a reasonably good job, reasonably stable, you form a partnership, you maybe think about having kids, you get your house, right? That's how you do it. And of course, Fine Gael's long-term suicide note really is, to destroy that mechanism, right? It has destroyed the basis on which people of Simon Harris's age get integrated into Irish society and feel reasonably content with the way things are. So this is where the incoherence of ideology actually becomes both self-defeating for a political party like Fine Gael, but also becomes destructive socially, right? Because it is failing to produce. So it's not producing a clear way in which, most people who, do the right things, work hard, get a good education, get a good job. I mean, do all the things they're supposed to do. They cannot get that sort of foothold in the society which comes from home ownership. And then they're also starting, people of Simon Harris's age are starting to think about the age of their parents. They're maybe having kids like he does. So they're thinking about the healthcare system. They're thinking about social provision. They're thinking about childcare. And finding that all of these things, are enormously fraught, are sources of anxiety rather than sources of security. So conservatism is not working in Ireland. And this is the crisis of Fine Gael. And this is why I think we have to see Leo Varadkar's, you know, shock announcement as not just about Leo Varadkar. Obviously, it's very personal and it's about his exhaustion and all the rest of it, but it's about the exhaustion of something else, right? Which is the deeper thing of what does this sort of centre-right politics stand for in Ireland?
Just in relation to that, Jen, I mean, I watched Simon Harris's speech in Athlone on Sunday, and he was a different Simon Harris from the Simon Harris that I felt I was familiar with from other outings of the previous Simon Harris, who was very touchy-feely and, you know, emoting on behalf of people and reaching out. This was a Simon Harris who was given the provost what for and who was standing up for small business and who would defend the security of the state. I found it a bit unconvincing. And, you know, we've talked a lot about performative politics on this podcast, so let's not go into it again. But it sounded to me that he was an overnight convert in a way, in a weird kind of a way, to what Fintan's talking about here, which is being overtly a centre-right Christian Democrat party, small business, low tax, all those kind of elements of that you would be familiar with from the Conservative parties, the CDU in Germany or whatever. Was there a kind of, did he do a pivot there? And does it matter at all? Is it purely performative, I suppose?
I think that the reason why you feel that is probably, like you say, because you've seen a very different version of him before. And there are different versions of Simon Harris, and he's going to have to become a different version now because Fine Gael is at an ideological crossroads. On one hand, by the virtue of being in government, they have become centre-left. Simon Harris was central to the abortion referendum campaign. I mean, his communication skills, and they are skills, it wasn't single-handedly, but very much he was the central figure in government in getting the middle ground on board and getting that over the line. And now he's taking over a party which is actively publicly calling for him to put it back centre-right. And we hear, you know, comments such as, we shouldn't be pursuing this woke agenda. Now, I hate the word woke and the fact that we're subscribing all political views to woke or anti-woke. It's just so reductive and ridiculous. But there's something to it.
Well, let's call it socially progressive.
That's not fair because I don't know, black and white terms, but basically...
But there is... Okay, well, not to get too much of this. There is a thing and we need a name for it.
There's a thing and we need a name for it. And we could go back to centre-left and centre-right. But if you look at the examples that people in Fine Gael TDs have been given over the last couple of days about things that should be ditched, different directions they should go in, they're talking about stuff like the hate speech bill. And now we see everybody rowing in behind ditching the hate speech bill. And why are they saying that? Did they suddenly overnight go, I hate this, I hate the hate speech bill? No. They're terrified about what happened in the referendum just gone. The massive scale, the humiliation and the defeat. I think they're looking at potentially woke issues and going, no, we're not getting on the public's wrong side. And that to me is entirely opportunistic. And
woke issues now include everything from late night bar openings to...
Oh, apparently this is the latest woke issue. Yeah. And actually that is a divisive issue among the public. A lot of people who think we should and a lot of people think we shouldn't. But there's a danger here for Fine Gael if they do decide to pull away and go in a different direction, because they have built the last, let's say they've worked the last 10 years or more on specific issues. They spent years working on the hate speech bill. Are they just going to abandon it now because we're all terrified of the woke brigade? I think there's a problem there if they lurch. And it's a bit similar to, it's a different topic, but what happened to Sinn Féin when they started to move on immigration, parts of their base who, you know, maybe would have had strong views about immigration but wouldn't have been as vocal as the far right or whatever.
And we've seen Sinn Féin left do a U-turn on the hate speech bill.
I just think they're at a crossroads, and I think that the call on Simon Harris is to pull the party back centre-right. And it's not me saying it, they're saying it themselves out loud. Michael Ring, Charlie Flanagan, etc.
So Fintan, avoiding the W word because it upsets Jen.
it upsets me as well, so thank you.
Okay. What way does the social democratic worldview, which you ascribe as being the majority worldview in Ireland, how does that fit with what you might call the culture war or socially progressive issues? And we know what they are. How do they fit together in the overall jigsaw of Irish politics? Because they certainly had a part to play in the referendum defeat. And it seems to me that the referendum defeat did have some impact on Leo Varadkar's decision to step down too.
Oh, I'm sure it did, you know, because it was if you ever want to see an example of your own leadership running into the sands, you know, his complete failure to articulate any sort of rationale for the referendums, particularly for the wordings, To give any real leadership there, I suppose you have to admire him for his honesty and looking in the mirror and saying, you know, this shows a tired politician. But the bigger issue, so again, let's stand back from it for a second, right? So what did the referendums tell us, right? They told us what we already know, but again, it's another big anomaly in Irish politics, right? So there's the one of having centre left policies run by centre-right parties. That's a huge anomaly. The other big anomaly is that you have, and have had, about a third of the electorate, which still identifies very broadly, right, with Catholic Ireland, you know, with what, after all, was one of the most powerful political and social constructs that this country's ever seen, you know, which was the Catholic world that was built from the 19th century and lasted really up to the end of the 20th. It would be surprising if you didn't still have a significant cohort of the electorate, you know, which identifies very much with that world. Remember, a third of people voted against repealing the Eighth. A third of people voted against equal marriage. You know, where do those people go? Right? And so the temptation for Fine Gael, and maybe for everybody else, right, is to say, let's chase that vote. And the referendum showed that vote is there, right, that symbolically, there was a significant cohort of people who said, I want to stick with the 1937 Constitution and its Catholic social teaching and the values that it contains. And they're perfectly entitled to, you know, to have that view. And part of the problem is, of course, that there is no coherent political representation of it. I wouldn't say they're completely disenfranchised, but, you know, there's AIM2, there's a number of independents, there's various kind of forces out there that might seek to represent them, but there is not a coherent one which has any real purchase on public policy at the moment. So that's a problem. And the second thing that the referendum told us was that what's happening is that in some ways the so-called liberal agenda has sort of run its course, you know, so divorce has been dealt with, contraception has been dealt with, abortion has been dealt with. These were the huge kind of wedge issues, right? And they were very important ones. What remains are, in a way, the real social issues. So we call those social issues, you know, whatever they're referred to in Ireland. The real social issues around, so all of those issues, for example, were about gender inequality. What was at the heart of those was, you know, controlling women's bodies, controlling their right to make decisions about how they reproduce. What are the real issues now about women and control? The real issues are around care. Right. So, again, this is not controversial. You know, you can look at report after report. We know the overwhelming burden of caring in Ireland is still carried by women. It's carried by women for children. It's carried by women for older people. It's carried by women for siblings. You know, whatever way you want to look at this, it is women who do the vast bulk of the unpaid caring work, and they are treated abysmally in the society. And you know, you cannot deal any further. You can't go any further with gender equality, even, you know, without tackling care. And what did we get? We got an excellent process, right? We know how to do these things. This is the stupidity of this whole thing. We know how to do referendums because we've done them really badly so often. By trial and error, we found a way of doing it. Citizens' convention, Oireachtas committee, draft legislation, right? That's what you do. Citizens' Convention came out with very good wording. Oireachtas Committee basically endorsed the same wording. Government ditches both of those, never explains why, hides behind legal advice, which we can't tell you about, and then does not produce draft legislation. Why? What was at the core of that? Because to put some sort of genuine recognition of caring into the Constitution, which I believe we should do, would be a social democratic statement, right? It would be a statement that actually we think society has, as a whole, has an obligation to support carers. What did the wording say? It said that carers support society. So the other way around. I mean, 1930s Catholic social thinking they went back to, you know, and it was offensive and it was wrong and it was politically inept, right? And it showed the crisis again, the same crisis of, you know, wanting to somehow sort of surf on an idea of social change and progressive change, which Fine Gael wants to identify itself with, but very much then, running away from the implications of that in terms of actual government and actual social policy, and actually giving people, and particularly women who have to do the caring, some sense that they're not patted on the head and that that's recognition, but that recognition actually involves, and again, this is why someone like Tom Clonan, for example, was so powerful in relation to all of this. You know, what does it mean? What does it mean to be a carer in Irish society? It means you get no respite. It means you're banging your head off the wall day after day after day, trying to fight for basic things for your child. It means that, and this is, again, it's mostly women, have to put their careers on hold, have to put their other lives on hold, you know, in order to try to fulfill these functions. So, you know, they ran up against reality here. You know, the two realities, the reality that there is still a significant conservative Catholic vote in Ireland, and that the progressive vote now is going away from simply saying, oh, look, abortion is a really important issue for us. It's actually, what are you going to do about it? What social policies might follow from, you know, vaguely nice sounding, you know, slogans about how nice and good and progressive we all are.
Yeah, I'm tempted to, but I will not go into the weeds of talking about the difference between negative and positive rights and how the idea of negative rights are traditionally a centre-right kind of a position, the right to free speech, the right not to be interfered with by the state. Positive rights are actually that things like a right to housing being enumerated, a right to that carers to receive a support. But that is deeply ideological, I'd say, and that's probably a subject for another podcast. But Fintan has laid it out pretty well there. I want to go to the other implication of what he's saying, Jenna. This is the last thing we'll touch on, which is that there's something vacuous at the heart of Fine Gael's presentation to the public these days, after this long time in government, that it wants to be one thing in one way and one thing in another, and neither one rings entirely true. And one of the things that has struck me over the last few days is we've had a historical moment of unity where the conservative columnist David Quinn and our own columnist Una Mullally were as one on Simon Harris. They both agreed that his social media is embarrassing and he looks shallow. And is that a threat to him as well, in that, I mean, I think what you've been saying is that he's been a very effective, very very active, very modern, very young politician. But the other side of that is people might say it's all sizzle and no steak.
Depends, really. Depends on your personal opinion of it. But I do believe that younger people especially do prefer his style of communication and think that he is more genuine in his communication than his predecessors.
They don't find him a bit cringe, no?
I think a lot of people find any kind of talking to camera, online, on Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, wherever, a bit cringe. And I think that's a personal thing. But I remember in February 2021, it was around then, Simon Harris had been doing these videos on Instagram, his evening walk, basically, where he talked about what was happening with COVID and everybody was so scared and all that. And I remember bumping into him afterwards and I'd noticed that underneath those videos, it was 95% positive. And that is extraordinarily rare. It's usually 95% dogs abuse in the comments of politicians' videos, wherever they may be. And I remember him saying that he, at the time, he was trying not to be too polished, didn't want to be too slick.
Would be authentic.
He thought it'd be better to be yourself.
Everybody's dream.
I think I remember him saying something to me like, I'm just trying to level with people and not bullshit them. And I think people did pick up on that. I do genuinely believe that there are Fine Gaelers who think that he can reach out to a harder to reach group that have abandoned Fine Gael, which is younger voters. Can he take what he has harnessed over the last couple of years and can he transform that into extra votes for Fine Gael? I am very unconvinced.
And can he keep Michael Ring happy as well at the same time?
Nobody can keep Michael Ring happy. Even Michael Ring couldn't keep Michael Ring happy if he was a minister. But I'm doubtful about whether those clicks translate to votes. I really am.
Yeah, Fintan, last thought from you. But what do you think of this whole TikTok Taoiseach thing? I mean, one of the things that strikes me is, I mean, a couple of reports over the last week about the toxicity of the environment in which politicians have to operate now. And a huge amount of that is because of social media and the dog's abuse and worse that they have to put up with in social media. There's an element of something with the devil about the whole social media friendly Taoiseach part of it, isn't there?
There very much is. And I'd agree with Jen here. I mean, he deserves credit for being in that arena, right? So whatever we think about the toxicity of it, it's really important that democratic politicians, and let's remind ourselves, after all, he is a democratic politician. He will be democratically elected as Taoiseach by an elected parliament, you know, and it's really, really important that people like him, you know, people of his age are active in that arena and are trying to, you know, create some sort of messaging which is not toxic, you know. So I cringe at the stuff he does, but it's not aimed at me, right? So, you know, that's fine. At least he is there, and he's trying to do something, and he's obviously, insofar as it goes, very, very effective at doing that. I think the transition is, you know, when you get to be Taoiseach, right, is what does all that mean, right? So, yes, younger voters might be very delighted to see a Taoiseach who's kind of comfortable on social media, but they're also going to want to know, you know, what are they going to do about housing? What are they going to do about, you know, about the issues that actually matter so profoundly to all of them? And if you just take a simple, like, this is his dilemma, right? So, what's the red meat that the party faithful want to hear, who are mostly older, by the way, of course, you know, they want to hear tax cuts. Tax cuts is of no interest to somebody in their 20s or 30s in Ireland, right? Because they know that means, you know, the lower investment and lower intergenerational transfers of wealth, right? So somebody of my age, fantastic, tax cuts, great, you know, put it in the back pocket. Somebody who's struggling in their 20s and 30s, you know, who desperately needs public provision, is not going to be appealed to by tax cuts, right? So even if you just take a simple or apparently simple issue like that, you know, you know, this thing about making work pay, he's using these kind of cliches. It sounds fine, you know, but it's code for cutting taxes. And I just don't think there's actually any political purchase among voters under 45 for any of that. You know, it appeals to reasonably well-off, reasonably well-established older voters, you know, people of my age group, you know, and so, you know, his youth, you know, can be wasted on the old. And I don't think that's the way he should go.
We'll leave it at that. That's a nice line. We'll leave it at that. Thanks very much to Fintan for joining us. Thanks also to Jen. Thanks to our producer, Declan Conlon, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. We won't do a Friday wrap this week because it is Easter weekend, but we'll be back next week. I look forward to seeing you then.